everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capitol Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside scoop on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can find us on restaurantguysradio.com, the Heritage Radio Network, and of course, you can download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm fine, and I'm a little riled up as I am wont to be.
You do get riled up in the morning sometimes, huh?
You know, we have to speak on a topic that we've actually spoken about in the past.
This is something we probably haven't talked about for years, honestly.
Well, the school lunch program is. Our system is flawed. Our system of government and our system of commerce and food is flawed in a number of ways. And that the Department of Agriculture and the USDA are captive, they're captive regulating bodies. And the USDA is charged with promoting the beef industry, the meat industry in the United States, which is good. We should have an agency like that. They're also charged with regulating the meat industry. We need an agency like that.
Yeah.
But they can't be the same agency.
Can I tell you, I know the sports analogy, so I apologize for going outside the box here on you. But it's very much like the NCAAs for those of you who are sports fans. The NCAAs can't get out of its own way, and one of the reasons they can't get out of their own way is because of just the same reason as you have here. Being responsible for regulating and responsible for promoting are not necessarily your goals are not necessarily aligned.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, of course, that the meat industry, the USDA, is captive to the meat industry because the USDA is populated with people running it who are former meat lobbyists and executives who then, after they stop working for the government
again... I was
going to
say, worse than being former meat lobbyists and executives are that the open and revolving door to them after they work for the USDA.
Of course.
So because that, to me, that's the bigger issue. You can have worked, you could have worked someplace else and still come to this kind of, with an open mind. I think that guy's going to be my employer someday. It really jades the system.
Maybe after I make this big decision that makes him millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, billions of dollars.
Which is exactly what happened with Beef Products, Inc. For years, forever, there's a substance called pink slime. And pink slime is connective tissue and other very low nutrition rendering. It's sort of technically meat, but it's not. You know, if you think of meat as muscle, it's not all muscle. It's connective tissue, and they're called lean beef trimmings. They're called.
It's the stuff that probably at your house, if you were to get a piece of meat. That if any of it were on your piece of meat, you would throw in the garbage.
Yeah, of course,
It's the stuff you would clean off of your meat, or that we clean off of our meat here in the restaurant and throw away.
Right. So, but lean, and I love it. They call it boneless lean beef trimmings, as if it's like a fillet or something, right? What it's called, anecdotally, what it's referred to is pink slime. And if you've seen it, and if you go to look at Jamie Oliver's wonderful series Food Revolution. You can see where he shows you pink slime in a part of it. And you can see it if you go to YouTube and look for pink slime.
Yeah, it's been getting a little bit of play on YouTube. And you know, I saw a Facebook thing go around on pink slime.
Well, Morgan Spurlock and Jamie Oliver both have spoken out against pink slime. And it was reclassified because formerly this stuff would go for renderings or for pet food. It is also a part of beef that is... very high in pathogens. And so if you want to use these renderings, which are, again, the connective tissue that we used to throw away.
And one of the reasons that it's high in pathogens, again, is it has lots of exposure.
Right.
It has lots of sides.
So
because it's little bits and pieces of, like chopped meat has more danger to it than a big steak because it's ground. And it's got lots of surface area is the word I'm looking for. Two words, actually.
Well,
but pink slime has lots of surface area.
And plus, they found that in the base material of pink slime, it's more likely to contain dangerous pathogens than muscle meat, even ground beef. Now, what they do, they know this, and so they treat it with ammonia hydroxide. It gets spritzed with a little bit of ammonia, which they have now said, the USDA has now said that it's safe, and lean beef trimmings, pink slime, treated with ammonia... ammonia hydroxide can be blended in with to your ground beef that you pick up in the supermarket or in the restaurant you go to, and you don't have to be told about it. It doesn't have to say that it contains lean beef trimmings. This is what used to go into dog
food. Or ammonia hydroxide.
This is what used to go into dog food, okay, and renderings and industrial waste. And now it can be blended in to your ground beef, and you don't need to be told about it. The woman who made this change, who was responsible for making this change at the USDA, has since retired and gone to work for, surprise, surprise, the meat industry. And so Morgan Spurlock is doing some great work, and Jamie Oliver is doing some great work to raise awareness about pink slime. And so I believe it's Jack in the Box and McDonald's. No, Taco Bell and McDonald's have both said, no, we won't use any more pink slime.
It's too dirty for us.
Costco has said, no, no pink slime here. And Whole Foods says, no pink slime is allowed.
Obviously, Whole Foods says so.
Doesn't meet our standards. But McDonald's says, no pink slime. We're not serving ammonia-treated, almost nutritionless connective tissue. And I saw on television just recently, here's what we left out. The USDA is about to buy 7 million tons of pink slime and to put in school lunches. That's right. The fast food industry said, no, this isn't good enough for a McDonald's hamburger, and we're going to feed it to our kids.
See, this is, you know, literally food that is normally dog food.
Right. Dog food to our kids.
It's literally food that is normally dog food.
Used to be only good enough for dog food. No, can't put that in people food. You know what? Change your mind. Yes, you can.
But now you've cleaned it with ammonia.
Well, I think they used to do that before they put it into dog food as well.
And I don't want food that needs to be cleaned with ammonia.
Mm.
I don't want to eat it.
Especially if they don't tell me when it's on the label.
I don't want to eat food that's been that needs to be cleaned with ammonia.
Yeah.
More importantly than
right.
is cleaned.
Right. Even if they irradiate it or do whatever to it. So it's nutritionless filler, and they won't. But they don't have to label it as filler, right? You throw other stuff in there, you got to label it as filler, right? And I was watching television the other night, a rarity for me, and there was a representative from the Meat Institute or the Meat Council, and she was saying, I don't know what you want. It's meat. It's from the cow. It's meat. So there's no reason to label it any differently. So my question is, the hoof, if we
right
put the hoof in there.
Exactly what I was going to say.
Is that?
I was going to say.
The hair, if we throw a little leather in there, is that also beef? You idiot. No, I'm sorry. You're an evil person
right,
who thinks
you
that
do
I'm
know
an
better,
idiot.
Because
you know?
Right. You could, because you're treating me and the American public like they're idiots.
So this is a regulatory issue that you can call your senator and you can call your congressman about. It's a USDA issue. There are lots of petitions out there. If you go to change.org, you can find a petition. If you just Google it on the web, you're going to find a lot of information about it. Pink slime, evil. And pink slime, unlabeled, really evil. Pink slime, unlabeled, forced on our school children. I don't think it gets any better than that.
That's as bad as it gets.
Yeah, it's pretty evil stuff. So I would go and take a look at that.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're with the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com.
Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And today, returning to the show is our friend, Chef Floyd Cardoz, formerly of Tabla in New York City and now of the North End Grill.
Hey, Floyd, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Francis, and welcome. Great to be back.
I had, in the spirit of full disclosure, I have to say that I came in and I had a little lunch at the North End Grill, your new digs down in Battery Park City, and it was great, really great.
Thank you so much.
So, you know, when we last had you on the show, we were talking about Tabla, which was your sort of contemporary vision of Indian cooking as done in the United States. And the North End Grill is not that. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes. So Tabla used to be what I called a new Indian restaurant, where I did food that was from the West, that was adapted with Indian spices, Indian flavorings, and Indian cooking techniques. And I did food from India that was adapted to the West by using American, you know, techniques, flavorings, ingredients. And the North End Grill is what we call a new American bar and grill. And the food we do at North End Grill, as the name suggests, is everything on the menu is grilled.
Right.
And be it a protein as a main course, or there's some element of grilliness, if you will.
Not girliness, but grilliness.
Yeah, grilliness.
Yeah, okay.
You know, we have three amazing grills. One is a wood burning grill, and what we do to that is we light the wood, make it into live charcoals, and move it to the side, and then we cook over these live charcoals. And the other is a charcoal, almost an oven, if you will, made by Woodstone, and it's called a Jasper oven, where we put maple charcoal inside. We light it up, you know, before service, and it kind of behaves like an oven, but is a grill.
Uh-huh.
So you grill and you roast at the same time.
And one of the things about a wood like maple is a nice hardwood, so you're not going to get a ton of smoke off of that. When people
exactly.
talk about the, you know, hickory or mesquite, those are softer woods and they smoke a lot. But maple is a hardwood.
Yeah, we also use oak and cherry on the wood grill, along with grape wood.
Yeah, I saw that when I was there. The grape with the vine trimmings are in the dining room, and you can sort of see them as you walk by. And I was with a friend of mine, let's say, who's a master of wine, and she's like, I know what these are.
Yeah. You know, the strange thing is that in Europe, France, you know, Spain, Italy, and in South America, where they have vineyards like Chile and Argentina, they use these old vines, trimmings, to cook on the churrascarias in South America, and in the grills in Europe. So they have been using these things, but in the United States we don't do much of that. So that wood is just what. When I went to a vineyard in Napa Valley and I saw this wood, and I asked the guy, I said, "What do you do with the wood?" He says, "You know, once it's all trimmed, we put it in the middle of a field and we have a giant bonfire."
Yeah,
I said, "You mean nobody uses this to cook on?" And they said, "No, nobody has
wow.
found use for it." So we're working with a vineyard in Long Island called Macari.
Sure, we know Macari.
Yeah, we get all their trimmings, and they're pretty big trimmings. You know, it's not twigs.
Right, sure. You know, speaking of pretty big, I saw the wood burning grill, the one that you see when you come in, and it's got these big wheels that raise and lower the grates of the grill over the. It's a pretty impressive sight there, Lloyd.
It is a pretty impressive sight, because it has two grilling surfaces that are suspended by these huge cables that move the grill up and down depending on how the heat is, and depending on how fast we are getting the live charcoals going. So if we want something on a high heat, like say I'm doing sardines, I'm going to lower the grill down. But if I'm doing the 28-ounce strip steak that we have, I want the grill pretty much very high, because I don't want to give it. Because by the time that sucker cooks, it's going to be dark as hell.
Yeah, you don't.
And what I find is that the more gentler the heat and the more gentle the smoke, the better the meat tastes, because you can get the best of the smoke and you can get the best of the meat.
Because you have that big, thick steak and it's going to be on there for a while. So,
exactly.
So you can do everything.
So it's just, you know, everything we do takes. We do whole fish, like whole black sea bass, whole snapper, whole togo, all the grills.
You know,
And then the other thing we do is we do a whole roast chicken, and we finish it on top of the grill once it's done.
Well, we have to talk about using a wood-burning grill, or even you know, a charcoal grill, and the how different that is. In most restaurants you go to, you use a traditional gas grill, and whoever's operating that grill puts it on high or medium or low, and has constant temperature and can have a constant temperature throughout the entire grill and kind of manage that however they want it to be for that particular dish. You know, Francis and I have had a wood-burning grill here in Jersey here for almost 20 years now, and what you find out very quickly is you need somebody very talented to work a wood-burning grill, where in other restaurants your grill guy might be not be as talented as your sauté guy, might be one step below your sauté guy. But when you're working with a wood-burning grill where the temperature's different all the time, and the temperature is different on every part of the grill, that really takes a special talent, doesn't it?
It does, and you phrased it so very well, because when you're working that grill, and this is the only thing I tell the grill guys, and the guy who is working the grill in the evening has worked with me at Tabla before, so he understands my style, and he understands the way I speak and what I want him to do. From the first week, I worked with him every single service. I did not leave his side, and I told him, I said, the way you're going to beat the station is if you figure out the fire and
yep.
you figure out the heat, because that is constantly evolving and constantly changing. You know, it depends on what stage the wood is. If it's, you know, it depends on how much the vents are open. It depends you know, and where do you put the wood to get it to burn faster?
Yeah, it's an amazing, it's amazingly old-fashioned way of cooking. I mean, you know, to think about managing the fire is something that a modern cook really doesn't do.
No, yeah, and you're right. We've made it so easy by, you know, going into cryovac bags and sous-viding everything that the old techniques of how do we get the most of an ingredient using a primitive, you know, cooking technique and making it phenomenal.
But
it's,
we say
it's basically what everybody wants to do.
You say a primitive cooking technique, but in reality, it is so much harder to operate the wood-burning grill, but it offers so much more. There's so much more you can do with that wood-burning grill than you can with the traditional gas grill. Traditional gas grill gives you only heat. A wood-burning grill gives you a whole set of dimensions that you don't get otherwise.
That's so true. It's so true. And the more we're using it, we've been open for 2 months now, Northern Grill, the more we use it, the more we figure out is like, wow, this is a really cool. And, you know, yesterday I did sweetbreads on the grill for an hour. I'm cooking my cauliflower on the grill when I start the fire up because I want a little bit of smoke.
Uh-huh.
I'm doing pumpkin puree and I'm giving it a little bit of smoke. So I'm doing things on the grill. You know, we cooked a Mangalese pork neck today for lunch. We had a special today from a farm in New Jersey. And that thing was pretty big, but stayed on the grill so close to 2 hours of the guy constantly babying it and turning it, and when it was ready and we cut into it, it was phenomenal. You know, that pork as it is so good, but just the scent of smoke made it so much better.
Well,
Floyd, here's an opportunity actually to talk about something that I hadn't anticipated talking about it, but you brought in a Mangalista pig. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, that particular breed of pig and why you would use that breed?
You know, I believe in utilizing what's best from an area, you know. So my meat, I'm getting pigs from this farm. I'm getting pigs from farms in Pennsylvania, getting my lamb from Pennsylvania. And I believe if you get what's local and what's good and grown well, be it any kind of heritage pig, it's going to have so much more, and I hate to use the word porky flavor, that it's just going to make, you know, a lesser cut of meat taste so much better.
Well, and when you use a product like Mangalista pig, and there is, and I'm trying to remember the name of this farm that's here in Jersey, but I can't remember it off the top of my head. We'll probably put it up online because that's the kind of guys we are. But when you use a product like that, each pig is different than the other pig, and some chefs don't like that. Some chefs want to know exactly what they're getting and they want it to be exactly the same each time so they can reproduce that and have it reproduced by, you know, the people who work for them. But I'm a big believer in give me something that's a little bit different each time, but better each time. That offers me more choices, not fewer.
Yeah. The Mangalista pigs is on the Moose Fund.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You know, you're right. Most chefs want something to be constant. They want it to be the same size. They want it to have the same fat content. But nature is not that way. If nature has its way, you know, if you have spring milk, is going to be different from milk in the fall, only because the grasses are different.
Right.
That these animals are eating. The same with the pigs.
Right.
When it's colder, there's going to be more fat. When it's warmer, it's going to be less fat. It depends on the diet. So every single time, it will be different. And as a diner, you know, enjoying these nuances makes it so much better. And, you know, I did a Mangalista neck. Now, everybody wants loin and chop. Or belly. So I'm doing a neck, and this is a cut that is a lesser cut, but has so much flavor in it. And when you do use these, I believe, as a chef, it pushes you a little bit more to try and get the right mix and the right cooking technique. And for me, that's what drives me. You know, I want to be the guy who cooks from my heart every single time and has to figure out what can I do with this cut of meat today because, A, the fat content is different. B, the meat is a little redder today because the pig ate something different, has been running around, it's been too hot, it's been too cold. his genes were different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the beauty about food, is that you can do that. Because if you wanted the same thing again and again and again, and you could go to McDonald's and get the same burger 100 times and it would taste the same.
Yeah, no matter where you are.
Yeah.
You know,
why would we want that?
You know, obviously we're all on the same page. I think anybody who's listening to the show is on the same page with regard to that philosophy of food as well. What I found very interesting is I know that going to North End Grill, I'd read that you were there, and we stopped in, and actually things were kind of busy, and so we didn't say hello until the meal was over. So I got an unbiased opinion of a great lunch. And, you know, when you hear the word grill, like, oh, it's a grill. And, like I said, one of the tools in our arsenal is a wood-burning grill as well, and it's a magical thing. But when you hear the word grill, generally, you think, oh, well, it's just a place where they maybe buy a good product and grill it, and it's very simple. With your many different kinds of grills, I mean, I think you're grilling on a different level than anybody in Manhattan, don't you think?
When we decided that we were going to do a grill, we said, let's take a grill, and this could be Applebee's, a neighborhood bar and grill, and let's upgrade it. Let's figure out a way to get the most out of the grilling concept, and let's see what we can add to the dialogue, because Applebee's is great, and it's good for what it is, but we don't want to be Applebee's.
Right, right.
Can I just say, on this show, you don't need to say that Applebee's is great.
Yeah, no.
It's really okay with us.
No, but Applebee's fits a niche.
Yeah,
for and people who can't afford to eat at better places, and hopefully they will someday get some very good ingredients. But so we said, let's take the grilling concept. Let's do grilling at its best. And grilling at its best is where it's done in Europe and in South America, where they use wood, where they use charcoal, and they massage the meat, if you will,
right,
to get the most out of it.
Right.
But that's what we wanted to do, and we said, since the way I cook is, I cook at home, I cook very seasonal. Let's take a grill, which most grills don't change the menu. It's 80% meat and a token salmon and a lobster. And that's a grill menu. So we're doing sardines and calamari and octopus and, a strip steak and whole chicken and halibut. And, so I'm taking ingredients. I'm taking, shrimp from, New Orleans. My oysters are all north from the Atlantic. From Long Island, from Maine, from, Massachusetts. So let's take all these elements and upgrade it, and that's what we're doing. We're just trying to make it better.
Well, now let's talk about the concept of the North End Grill and where you come from. You were raised in Mumbai and Goa, right?
Yeah.
And you came to the United States, and you cooked around the United States, and you had this phenomenal, heavily Indian-influenced restaurant Tableau, which we ate at a number of times.
Great
and
place.
Loved and thought was fantastic. And you taught us a lot about spices, things we didn't even know. And now, you're at the North End Grill. Tableau is closed, kind of a victim of the economy. You're back with Danny Meyer again at a different concept restaurant. Are you bringing any of those Indian influence, those spice influences into the North End Grill? Or what role does that, what's it like to make that transition in New York today?
If you go to any fine dining restaurant anywhere in the world, be it New York, be it Miami, be it Los Angeles, be it London, be it Paris, be it Rome, I'd say Rome is out of it, but every single fine dining restaurant, 2-star, 1-star, 3-star Michelin restaurant, is using spice in some way or the other. This was not true 15 years ago, but today everybody has found that you can enhance flavor and make it more interesting by using spices. So if I said at the North End Grill I was not using spices, I'd be lying.
Sure, right. Okay. Of course.
It's not up front, it's not in your face, and it's not Indian. But there are different kinds of chili peppers that I'm using from Mexico, from the U.S., from India. I am using spices from the Middle East, from India, from, the Far East. So there are spices in the meal, but it's not predominant,
mm-hmm.
and it's not the star. So it is making it more interesting. But you can't say, I think that's what there is in there.
Right.
Because it's the way you go to any restaurant today, and there is flavor enhancers. And I'm using natural flavor enhancers. I'm not using chemicals, but I'm using these essential oils that are present in spices that we grind. And it's not, at Tabla, it used to be a lot of spice in a lot of dishes. At North End Grill, it's hints. And actually, there was a friend who came in last night, and he says, I don't see any India there. I said, you know, if you delve into it, if you go into it, you're going to find something that's different.
You're accenting the food.
And that's what's making it taste so good.
You're accenting the food.
Exactly.
All right,
a few years ago, Floyd, somebody asked me what I thought the next trend or one of the new trends would be in food. And my response was, I think that people are going to pay more attention to eggs. And it would appear that you and I are on the same page there. You've created an entire egg section on your menu. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, when Danny and myself were talking about menu and how we were going to structure the menu and what it was going to look like, we went back and started pulling menus from the early 1900s. And some of the menus we saw had the grand French banquet with the 13 and 14 courses, and one of the courses in that meal was œuf, which is eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it, and Danny looked at it, and the both of them, we looked up and said, huh, that's interesting. And at that point in time, I told Danny, I said, you know, Danny, I'd love to do eggs. There are a bunch of chefs who love to do eggs. I think eggs are understated, but we all put a token egg dish on our menu. And if a chef goes out to eat, they always order an egg dish.
Absolutely.
That's what I do.
Sure, sure.
Absolutely. You tell me there's going to be an egg yolk floating
in this.
If you tell me there's going to be an egg yolk floating on top, I'm whatever that dish is, I'm getting it.
Yeah,
when I go to the ramen place, I always get the egg in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We make our cocktails, there's always an egg white in them, as a matter of fact. Well, not always, but often. So what you have a whole egg section there. How's that being received by the public?
It's being received very, very well. It's being received better than I thought it would be. People are into it. People enjoy it. And because you're treating eggs, you know, we have a poached egg, we have a scrambled egg, we have an omelet, we have a slow-cooked egg. And then we have a quail egg on top of a tartare. Now, every tartare traditionally had an egg in it, egg yolk.
Right, sure.
So we're doing a tuna tartare, and we're putting a fried quail egg on top.
Yeah, well, I'm all about the eggs, and I have to say the North End Grill is a pretty cool place to visit, and it's good to see you cooking again in Manhattan, Floyd.
Thank you very, very much. I'm happy to be back.
And you can find out more about the North End Grill and Floyd Cardos and what he writes and says and cooks at therestaurantguysradio.com, and I hope you'll check it out. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and at restaurantguysradio.com.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. You know, I hate to belabor the point. I don't want to beat you over the head with a bat.
But Francis is a belaborer.
Yeah, I am. Wood-burning grill. Do you know that I have at home a great gas grill? You know, I got it when I moved into my house.
Sure.
It's a big gas grill. It has two side burners. It's
wonderful
great.
Gas grills at
you
home.
Know what I have in the garage? I have the Kettle Weber grill.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I like the Kettle, the Weber grill, is because there's room in there to throw a log or two on top of your charcoal.
Yep.
Totally changes the flavor.
You know that I cheat even with my my gas grill at home.
Wood chips?
I'll throw some chips or something in there. When I do charcoal now, we use this Jack Daniel's charcoal.
Yeah.
And it's the chopped up Jack Daniel's barrels mixed in with the charcoal.
Yeah.
And not that the Jack Daniel's barrels are this really special wood. It's just they'll impart this really cool wood smoke flavor that you can only get from wood. Charcoal doesn't have it.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
bag charcoal just isn't the same as using wood or even wood charcoal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have to say the whole wood thing I'm a big fan of. Mm-hmm. And even on my gas grill, there's a little compartment where you can put in like wood shavings. Not the same.
Oh, it's not the same.
But I really do like that the old Weber kettle grills, because they go down to the bottom and you can throw in a log or two there, and they're not expensive and they're really great.
Yeah,
so
I'm sure that I go through a grill every 3-4 years because I'm putting stuff in there that's not supposed to go in there.
Yeah, the gasoline and the explosives.
I have never used gasoline in my gas grill.
That's good.
Once yet.
That's good. All right, well, I hope you all have enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly have. My name is Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.